John chapter 6 and verse 30. What did the Jews ask for and why? What did they ask for? A sign. Why? That they might believe. Here even the Jews connected the idea of a sign with a foundation for faith, a reason to believe in the claims of Jesus Christ. In John chapter 3 and verse 2, how did Nicodemus define signs? No one can do the things you're doing unless God is with him. There are several terms that are used of miracles. Works, something done. Sign points to something. A wonder, it causes wonder. Powers, it demonstrated power. And then, of course, the word miracle. And so here's the word signs being used, that it pointed to or indicated something about the person doing it or his message. But he's talking about what we call miracles. This is as good a definition of miracle as you're going to find right here. Nobody can do what you're doing unless God is with him. So we use the term supernatural. Something a person can't do naturally. As skilled as they are, how much money they have, what position they hold, they cannot do it. God must empower them to work a, quote, miracle. All right, John 20, 30, and 31. Now, John here clearly looks at what we're studying. He said, many other signs Jesus performed that are not written in this book. But he said, these are written, why? That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. That is clearly the intent and purpose of the record of the miracles that you have in the New Testament. We don't have all the miracles Jesus performed, but we have a sufficient number, kind, to clearly give us a solid foundation for believing that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, the faith of Jesus Christ, or sometimes we use the word Christianity, who Jesus is, his identity. We've been putting ourselves in the jury box. Jesus is on trial. Who is this man? His identity will stand or fall on this one foundation itself. Look over, if you will, at John chapter 5 and verse 36. We're going to look at others, and Matt mentioned one we're going to look at in later lessons, if the Lord is willing, prophecy. But we're looking at miracles, and this was one that was pointed to even by Jesus. Look at John 5:36. We've been talking about witnesses, testimony. We've been looking at human testimony, and we're going to look at human testimony relative to miracles. But note, he talks about another kind of witness. The witness I have, verse 36, is greater than that of John. John was a human, and he gave testimony. But he said, I have a witness that's greater than that. What is it? The works which my Father has given me to accomplish, the very works which I do, bear witness of me. So Jesus himself squarely laid the truth, the credibility of the gospel on the question of whether or not he did these things he was attributed with doing, the works he did. Look over at John chapter 10 where he makes this challenge. John chapter 10 verse 37. Over there in John 5 he said the works bear witness. Here's John 10. He used that term again. Verse 37. If I do not do the works of my Father, know what he says. Do not believe in me. That's fair, isn't it? So it stands or falls here. If he did not do these miracles, he said, don't believe me. And note he says, but if I do them, though you do not believe me, that is what I say, he said, believe the works. So that, what's the purpose? You may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. That there's a perfect unity between the God you claim to worship, the Father God, and myself. And so again, he appeals, you see here, to the miracles. Look at Acts chapter 2 and verse 22. Acts chapter 2, 22. This is a first day of the week. It's the day of Pentecost. Peter is preaching along with the other apostles to this audience. Are they believers in Jesus as the Messiah? Are they? No, they're not believers. Look what he says in verse 22. He said, men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus of the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God. How? Here it is. Not with some feeling in your heart, some vision you saw. With miracles and wonders and signs. Three synonyms, all talking about miracles, but just different facets of them. They excite wonder and they point to who he is. Miracles, wonders, and signs. Now note this. Which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. Look, for Peter to open up this sermon that way, if Jesus had not performed miracles before this audience, was there any need for him to proceed with that sermon? Would his audience have been receptive? Obviously not. He says, you know what he did in your presence. And he appeals to that as God's witness or attestation or proof of who Jesus is. So don't be afraid to recognize that miracles are a solid foundation for believing in Jesus Christ. Now, you know, it's awfully foggy outside. You can't see very far. And it's dangerous driving. It's a miracle you made it here today, isn't it?
No.
No, it isn't. Do people use it that way?
Yes.
I was listening to a program on the Weather Channel the other day, and they were talking about bad weather. And there was this tall, big tree in the middle of an esplanade. Cars coming by. Wind blew the tree over, crushed the car. The guy said, the driver miraculously escaped. True? Did he miraculously, based on the definition we've been reading?
No.
Does God work quote unquote miracles, do things that men can't do today? I don't know about that. That's not our discussion. Remember, a miracle is something a person does that they could not do unless God is with them. That's what we're talking about when we talk about miracle. I've got an illustration. I don't know if you parents discuss this with your children. You've probably seen this, if nothing else, on TV shows or movies. Maybe on news at times. A car goes over a cliff. It's 300 foot down. The car turns over and over and over and over, maybe 10 times. Every glass is busted out. The thing's a total wreck. And yet the people survive. And that'll be described as miraculous. But is it? No. So is it wrong to use the word miraculous that way? No. Because words change meaning. Words are like rivers. Today, that's how we use the word miracle. It's miraculous. But we must understand what was meant when you read your New Testament. That's why we have these verses we started with, John 3, 2. And we'll see others as we go through. So that's very important. All right, so we're talking about miracles. How do you go about proving a miracle? So we have on your lesson some questions. We've got some parents here who do homeschooling. How do you prove 2 + 2 = 4? How could you prove that? Some of you homeschoolers, how would you prove that to your young children?
You show them. You lay it out in front of
them. So you take two apples. 1, 2. You put two more apples. 1, 2. And have them count them, right? You prove it by demonstration. Right? That don't have to just depend on you saying it. It's not a matter of feelings. It's a matter of demonstration. Okay? Now, here's another question. You tell your children, don't touch the stove. I just got through cooking something. It's hot. Kids, I don't know if I believe you. How can they find out if it's true?
Touch the stove.
By personal experience, by sensation. That's another way to prove something. So they can go touch it and they'll find out mom was warning them correctly. Well, here's another question. How can you prove the Declaration of Independence was signed on July the 4th, 1776? Can you demonstrate it? Can you do it by touch or sense? How do you prove it?
Testimony.
That's right. Testimony. Now, are you just as sure that the Declaration of Independence was signed on July 4, 1776 as you are 2 + 2 = 4? Yes. And yet one is a matter of demonstration. Are you just as sure about the Declaration of Independence as the stove is hot right after mom just finished cooking on it? Yes. But one is proved by demonstration, one is proved by experience, sense, and one is proved by human testimony. And we act upon that. So we have a celebration every year about the Declaration of Independence, don't we? July the 4th. We act like we believe it, though we have it. It's not proved by sense, by demonstration, but by testimony. Here's another one. If somebody tells you cyanide is poisonous, and you have confidence in their testimony, do you have to drink it to find out? No, you don't. You act upon the testimony. Miracles are not proved by demonstration. Nobody can demonstrate a miracle today. They're not proved by personal experience. We'll talk about that more. Whether miracles are genuine, whether miracles happen, are proved in the same way you prove the Declaration of Independence was signed or cyanide is poisonous, by testimony. Okay? So, we're going to be looking at that in the course of our study this morning. It's very important. So, it's really a historical issue. The Declaration of Independence, signed on July 4th, that's a historical issue. So you establish the truth or falsity of it by historical testimony. Same thing with miracles. It's a historical issue. We're going to look at the historical data, the testimony that we have in your New Testament. All right. We've got a little exercise here. I don't know what the parents thought about this one, but I don't know if you did it with your children. But we had suggested this. We present this scenario. So let's say somebody comes up to Riker and says, Riker, you know your mom and dad are not your biological parents. What? Maybe Wyatt or Raylan. Maybe John. What? And he said, how do you know that? Well, they say, it's impossible. Why? Because you look so much different. You know, here's Sean. Look how short he is. Look at Melissa, how tall she is. Somebody said, that's her son. No, can't be. That's impossible. Look at the color of his hair. Look how tall he is. Look at Melissa. I said, no, can't be. It just doesn't fit. It's impossible. Well, somebody else says, you know, Melissa says that's her boy. But somebody says, I have never seen, and I don't know of anyone who's seen, a woman with Melissa's hair, as tall as she is, having a short, red-headed boy. So if I've never seen it, and I don't know of anybody that has, it can't be so. Here's another. You say, but look, Keith and Melissa say that he is. His grandparents say that he is. The family says that he is. I don't care what you say. Human testimony will never prove to me. For example, that Riker belongs to Matt or Keith or John belongs to Amy and Michael. I just don't believe it. What people say about it. And then, somebody says, here's another factor. You know what? There are people who think and have thought all their lives that their parents are their biological parents and find out they're not. That happen? Yes. So, there's no way to know that these children are biologically the children of Michael and Amy, because there's mistakes. There's sometimes purposely, sometimes just through ignorance. And so there's really no way to know, since there's people who think they're the biological children, and they're not. And finally, look, John, if you are really the son of these two people, I believe it. That would solve it. And so if I say I don't believe it, you're not. Now, do those kind of arguments, that kind of reasoning, have any weight? You're going to see as we continue this lesson, those are the kind of arguments. They're parallel. The kind of reasoning that people use when they deny that there were miracles. Things somebody did that they could not do unless God was with them. So let's address ourselves to that as we go through the lesson. So the reason miracles are denied. Now you can start out with a presupposition that completely rules out miracles. It's not a historical presupposition. It's a psychological presupposition. And that is that there's no God. And so it's a closed system. If you start with that presupposition, there is no God, yeah, you can rule out miracles. But it's not based on historical evidence. It's not based on objective testimony. It's just your own assumptions or views or whatever that may be. Your faith, if you please. Atheists have faith. They cannot prove there's no God. They believe there's no God. And so if you start with that, yes. But the fact is, if there is a God, point number one on your lesson, miracles are possible. So in Genesis 18 and 14, it's interesting these verses I gave you deal with different circumstances. So here in chapter 18 and verse 14, what was being announced to this couple? We're going to become parents. What's so big deal about that? How old was Abraham going to be when the baby was born? How about Sarah? 90. And how did Abraham consider his body according to Romans 4? Dead. Good as dead. Can't bear any children. Sarah laughed. Ha ha ha. Funny. Can you imagine? But look at the statement here in Genesis 18:14. Is anything too difficult for the Lord? There's the answer. No, Abraham can't do it. Sarah can't do it on their own. But if there is a God, it's not too difficult for him. So that's the deal with causing this aged couple to have a child. Look in Job 42. You know, Job had a problem with God letting him suffer. And He wanted to be able to have a court scene with God. I wish he was down here so I could question him. So, lo and behold, God comes to Job. Okay, Job, you're so smart. Answer this question, this question, this question, this question. And it was questions about the universe and how things are what they are and about the animal kingdom. It's questions Job had no clue. Why they were like they were and how they got to be that way, he had no clue. And so in chapter 42, in verse 2, he said, I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Job said, you know, I've talked when I should have been listening. There's nothing God can't do. Just look at what he's done. That's what God would say. What about this, Job? What about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? He said, there's nothing you can't do. If you can create a universe, cause rain, snow, create the animal kingdom, except there's nothing God can't do. In Luke 1:37, here's another interesting one. A marvelous announcement had been made to a young woman. She was a virgin, according to verse 27. And she was told, verse 31, she would conceive in her womb and bear a son. How can a woman who's a virgin have a biological son conceive in her womb? Well, good question. So we have here on your lesson, verse 37. Nothing will be impossible with God. If there's a God, a virgin birth is possible. If there's a God. And then in Acts chapter 26 and verse 8. Look at Acts chapter 26 and verse 8. Why is it considered incredible among you if God does raise the dead? You say you believe in God. You say you believe in the God of Genesis 1, that's the Jews. You say you believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God of Job. So when I talk about the resurrection of the dead, why does that bother you? As if that's impossible. If you believe in God, then he's able to raise dead bodies from the grave. That's his point. That's his reasoning. Is that reasonable? Is that logical? Now that doesn't prove he raises the dead, but it proves there's sufficient cause for the effect. That's what you're looking for. Here's the effect. A person's raised from the dead, for example. A deaf man is able to hear. A blind man is able to see. Is there sufficient cause? Reasonably, logically, for that effect. We're not just saying believe it in your heart, not that kind of thing. Is there logically an explanation? If there's a God, there's a logical reason. Now, people say miracles are impossible because of the unalterable laws of nature. But if there's a supreme being, can he alter the laws of nature? Sure. And can he use them in an unusual way for his purposes? Yes. That's miracles. That's miracles. So if you believe in God, it's not impossible. If you live in 1902, and somebody told you that it was possible for a machine, a heavy machine, to go through the air unsupported by anything, what would you have said? It's impossible. The law of gravity demands that machine's going to fall to the ground. Right? 1903, December. Two guys did it using natural laws. And so the Wright brothers flew an airplane. So what we may think is impossible, maybe because we don't know how to alter laws or use them to a certain effect, may indeed be possible. And if there's a God who made the laws and controls the laws, we don't live in a world where the laws are exclusive as if they have all the power. In fact, there's another power and a will that's beyond those laws. There, if many of you have availability on your devices or in your library at home to dictionaries, there's an old, old dictionary called Easton's, E-A-S-T-O-N, Easton's Bible Dictionary. I encourage you to go look up the definition of miracle in that dictionary. It's a great definition. It's an old, old work, but it's very, very good. It discusses some of the things that we're talking about today. So, miracles are impossible? No, they're not. Not if there's a supreme being that rises above the natural laws. In fact, put them in place. Well, here's another one. So, remember we started out with the biological parents. They said, that's impossible. No, it's not impossible. You may not understand genetics and how a brown-haired, tall woman can have a red-haired, short son. Because you don't understand it doesn't mean it's not possible. So that's the parallel to that illustration we gave a while ago. Well, here was the second one. They're contrary to experience. This was used by an infidel or atheist, David Hume, many, many years ago. Back, I think it may have been in the 1800s, I'm not sure. That miracles are contrary to the unalterable experience of mankind. Well, let's look at that a little bit. Are miracles contrary to all experience? A while ago, we talked about these biological children. We said, I have never seen, I don't know of anybody who's seen. Does that mean no one has ever seen? Guess what? I've seen it. And so when you say contrary to experience, what do you mean? Everybody's experience? That assumes the very point in question. Have there been people in history who actually experienced, saw a miracle? That's what we're looking at. We look at the historical testimony. That's what we're going to find out. Because I've never experienced, because nobody I know living today does, done many things. Somebody says, well, I've never experienced it. I've never seen a miracle. Well, you know what that is? If you reason that way, you say, therefore, miracles don't happen. That's reasoning like a butterfly. Let me explain what I mean. A butterfly, let's say it's born in the spring. It only lives 2 or 3 months. So you're trying to convince a butterfly that there's times of the year when there's no leaves on the trees and there's snow everywhere and the temperature is 30 degrees. And the butterfly says, that's stupid. I've never experienced that. Say, boy, that's great reasoning, isn't it? Now expand that. You live in the 2000s. There's a lot of centuries before you. Even before we started counting our years from the birth of Christ. Because I haven't experienced it, does it mean it hasn't happened? How many of you have experienced a volcano? How many of you experienced an earthquake? You know, because I haven't experienced something doesn't mean it didn't happen. But that's the kind of quote-unquote reasoning that's used to deny miracles. So I said, no, what I mean is it's contrary to the general and ordinary experience of mankind. And so, you know, you look around. I look at this audience. I don't see any other tall ladies with brown hair with little sharp red-headed boys. So it's contrary to the general experience. No, it isn't. Well, yes, it is. What that does is assume that if Melissa can have that kind of boy, that we ought to just see that everywhere. That assumes that. The fact is, it may be, and it fact is, that miracles by their design was not intended to be general and ordinary. That God didn't plan for them, for the populace to experience them down through the centuries. And he did it that way for a particular purpose. We've got an illustration on the back side of your page called the clock illustration. A great illustration written by William Paley, or it's in that book, Evidences of Christianity. He lived back in the 1800s. So he's got this illustration with a clock. So let's suppose you have this clock and it has an alarm on it. And you set the alarm to go off at noon. And so you tell the child, I want you to watch this clock and I want you to see what it's like, the nature of this clock. So he starts at 1 p.m. He watches it for an hour and 2 hours and 6 hours and 12 hours. So, nature of this clock, you just sit there and go around. It doesn't do anything. And he watches it for 20 hours and 23 hours and 23 hours and 58, 59 minutes. Bang, noon. Alarm goes off. By design. The clock wasn't designed to go off every minute or every hour. It was designed to go off at a certain time for a certain purpose. But wait, expand that. Let's suppose this clock was set to go off every 10 years or better, in a century. A century. So people watch the clock for a year, 10 years, 50 years, 90 years, 99 years, 11 months. This is there. But at the century mark, the clock goes off. And what if whoever designed that clock, before it went off, sent messengers out to people and say, here's what's going to happen. And the fact that that clock goes off is evidence that I sent them. That's miracles. They weren't designed to be general and ordinary. They were designed for a purpose. There were no miracles, for example, 400 years before Christ. There were miracles way back in the time of Moses. And you'll read a few in the prophets. But here's a time, special time, when God is going to send His Son to the earth. And He's going to set the alarm to go off. Miracles. To announce, this is my Son. I sent Him. That's the nature of miracles. Somebody said, well, no testimony can prove a miracle. Why not? If miracles are possible, why can't human testimony prove a miracle? John 20, 29 through 31. When Thomas said, I've seen, so I believe, what did Jesus say? Blessed are those who have not seen, but yet believe. How are they going to believe?
Faith.
Faith in what?
Testimony.
Testimony. These are written that you may believe. And so the belief in miracles, God, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, placed your belief in them on the basis of reading the evidence, the testimony. You know, if you'd lived in 1902 and you'd never seen a machine heavier than air going through the air without being propped up or supported. And you started talking to people about it. They said, no, that's not possible. I've never seen anything like that or whatever. Obviously, 1903, they'd be proved wrong. Well, let's move past December of 1903. And I think there were five witnesses when they flew that plane. Now, what if you go talk to those five witnesses? Let's say there's 50,000 people in your community. Let's say there's 5 million people in your state. But there's five witnesses who say, yes, it happened. I saw it. I was there. That the fact there's only five witnesses, it hasn't happened before. They had never seen it happen. Did that invalidate the reality of what happened? It doesn't, does it? But that's the kind of reasoning that are, quote unquote, that's used to discredit miracles. You know, there's something that you have to believe. You talk about faith. There's a fellow who wrote a book, and I think he's right. It takes a lot of faith to be an atheist. And that's true. Same thing is true here. You say, well, I don't believe the testimony. Well, which is more credible? To say, I don't believe all these witnesses who testified at different places, at different times. They were threatened. They were imprisoned. They were put to death. They were willing to give their lives. But they kept the same testimony. Believe every one of them was liars. Every one of them was deceived. Now, which takes more faith, to believe they told the truth? Every one of them was liars and dishonest and deceived. And then finally, if miracles truly happen, have it on your lesson, well, then everybody who's seen them should have believed in Jesus. Look, if these things happen, everybody would have been believers. That's not so. Look at Matthew 12. Look at Matthew 12. You know, we said a while ago, well, John, if you were the biological son of these two, I'd believe it. And then if I don't believe it, it's not so. Well, he said, that's ridiculous. Exactly. And so here we have Matthew 12:22. There was brought to him a demon-possessed man who was blind and dumb, and he healed him, so the dumb man spoke and saw. All the multitudes were amazed and began to say, this man cannot be the son of David, can he? When the Pharisees heard it, they said he didn't cast out anybody. He didn't make the blind man see and hear or speak. Is that what they said? Did they deny the miracle? You'll never find them denying the miracle. Isn't that interesting? They didn't say he's a fraud. He didn't do it. They can't deny it. Everybody saw it. What did they do? What did they do? Did it by the power of the devil. They didn't deny the miracle. But they were not willing to give him the glory, the honor. Look at John 9. We'll study this in more depth in another lesson. John 9. Here's the blind man from birth who was healed. And so, I don't have time to read all of these. The Pharisees, verse 15, were asking him how he saw his sight. He told them how what Jesus had done, applied clay to his eyes, he washed and he saw. And so, what do they do? You'll note here in this passage, look down at verse, look down at verse 24. Second time they called the man who'd been blind and said, give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner. What are they doing? They can't deny the miracle. They've asked him, they've asked his parents, everybody they investigate, it's genuine. So what do they do?
Discredit.
Huh?
They discredit Jesus and then they turn on the man.
So how do you explain the miracle? God did it. Somebody else did it. Not this guy. That's the one thing. Give glory to God. Okay, the guy saved, but this guy didn't do it. Deny that Jesus was the source behind it. And then in Acts 4. So, these apostles go out. And they start preaching about the greatest miracle of all, which we're going to have a lesson or two on, if the Lord is willing. That is the resurrection of the body of Jesus Christ from the grave. And they're preaching that. Look back at verse 2. They were proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection of the dead. Did the rulers deny that it happened on this occasion? No. So what did they do according to verse 16 and 17? What did they do?
Told them not to speak about it.
Not to speak about it. Cover it up. Cover up the information. Don't be out here testifying. Okay, I can't deny it, but quit telling people about it. These are five of the reasons that miracles are denied. They're unreasonable. Hope that you see that. And so the Lord willing, in our next class, we're going to actually talk about Jesus' miracles. Outstanding lesson for our faith. We encourage you, if you haven't looked at it, look at a lot of verses there. You can select the ones you want if you wish. But at least look over the lesson, get familiar with it. Time will constrain us as to what we can actually cover in the class. But it's such an important concept. So I encourage you for our Wednesday night class to be ready to look at the miracles of Jesus Christ.